So hi everyone. Thank you for waving. I find myself quite happy. A little bit surprised to find myself so happy sitting here. But maybe I shouldn't be happy. I shouldn't be surprised. I was thinking that this topic that I'm going to talk about is one of the happiest topics in Buddhism. There's a story about this kind of happiness that I liked telling. I learned it from someone a long time ago. She was someone who grew up near here, near Redwood City, in Menlo Park, I believe. And she was a teenager in early 60s, high school student. Menlo Park, I don't know if you know this, but Menlo Park was kind of like one of this central staging grounds for the LSD culture, one of the places. And the Merry Pranksters and the Jeffrey and the Grateful Dead and places, things like that. These teenagers, you know, got whiff of this, you know, possibility of psychedelics, but then they heard that there was a Zen teacher in San Francisco, Shinryo Suzuki Roshi, the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, who knew how to get high without drugs. So she and her two girlfriends took the train or the bus up to San Francisco to back then into Japantown, where there was this old Japanese Soto Zen temple, and knocked on the door, and Suzuki Roshi answered, and they explained why they were there in order to get high without drugs. And Suzuki Roshi invited them in, maybe to the Zendo, sat them down, and he proceeded to give them a talk on the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, the arising of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way to the cessation of suffering. There, this one woman, that what got her attention was she'd never met someone who was as happy as Suzuki Roshi and as happy talking about suffering. And she's been a Zen student ever since. So anyway, with a little bit of luck, I'm not going to depress you today, but rather inspire you to talk about suffering. It is the good news in Buddhism, this way in which Buddhists address suffering, the whole discussion of willingness to experience it, to be really look at it deeply, is really the part of the really good news that there is a way to bring it to an end. And the end of suffering is not a mild thing. It's not like just like, I guess it's no longer there. And I'll just go on with my life and there must be interesting things to do. I'm kind of bored, but, you know, maybe I'll find something exciting to do. The end of suffering is not like a boring thing. It's not like a plain, dull thing. It's like one of the best forms of health you can ever experience, mental health, spiritual health. It's one of the most pristine experiences of well-being, of peace that a person can experience. But there's a very strong tendency in Buddhism, in early Buddhism, except calling it for peace and a kind of happiness, to not talk too much about the end of suffering as being something, some state, some experience, because many human beings then get attached to wanting that particular state, a particular experience. And as soon as you do that, you're back in the world of suffering. And so there's a lot of discussion about what it's not, non-clinging, non-grasping, non-craving. And it's a little bit of protection that it's really about letting go of something that brings about the suffering. It's not about getting something like conventionally. So it's a little odd, a little strange way of these Buddhists But there was a, I visited the monastery of Buddhadasa, a famous Thai meditation teacher who lived in southern Thailand. And he had a little art museum. And in the art museum, there was a copy of a kind of a cartoon that there was a monk near his monastery who had lived in a cave for many, many years. And then he died. And when he died, they went to the cave and they saw this, you know, Buddhist graffiti on the wall or something. And it was a cartoon figure of a Buddhist monk jumping up in the air with his hands out, a big smile, and like he's kicking his feet, like jumping up in the air, kicking his feet, and just, you know, so delighted in something. And then there's a caption of what he's saying as he's jumping in the air, and he says, "Oh, what boundless joy to know that there is no true happiness." What? What is going on with these Buddhists? No true happiness. And how I understand this is that there is happiness, for sure. But the true part is the dangerous part. To hold on to something, some experience, some constancy, some thing we can have with us all the time, or something. They're always going to be the same way, always going to be happy. To chase after that kind of happiness, probably that monk did that for decades in his cave. And then at some point he realized, wait a minute, there is no kind of permanent happiness that I can attain. There's something better. And in the cartoon, he's jumping in the air. And I kind of love this idea that he's kind of like totally free, like a bird, like in the air, left the pull of gravity in a sense. And so it's a whole different paradigm of how to live. So to suffer. So in a sense, what we're doing as Buddhist practitioners, believe it or not, and some of you will go home after I say this. You are home, so I got you. We're learning how to suffer better. Can you believe it? But not better so we suffer more. A better way of suffering so we can become free of the suffering, so we can get to the other side of it. But this idea of suffering better goes against the grain of everybody, way people try to live. A few people are masochists, so maybe they try, but we're not masochists. We're not in it for the suffering. We're in it for the freedom from it. So one of the forms of intolerance that characterizes Buddhists, ideally, would be an intolerance to suffering. That does not mean that we refuse to suffer. It means we refuse to give up to suffering. It means we refuse to let that be the status quo of our life. There's an intolerance because we want to practice as a way of becoming free of that suffering, of our suffering. And there's many reasons why people tolerate suffering. Sometimes it's because it's so familiar part of their life, they don't even know that's what it is. It's in, you know, it's completely, you know, foreign to them. I mean, it's completely foreign, the idea of being any other way. And so just this is what life is. They don't know they're suffering. Sometimes they're in denial. They don't want to face it. People are afraid of their suffering. Sometimes they have good cause for it, because if you really admit the suffering you have in a relationship, it might disrupt the relationship. If you address the suffering of you have at work, it might disrupt and make it difficult for you to work in the place. Addressing suffering sometimes is frightening. And so that's why people tolerate it, go along with it. Some people tolerate it because they're lazy. It seems like there's a lot of work to address it. I can't be bothered, or, you know, I have, it's just, you know, I have other things to do. Interesting things. Some people are distracted from it. They keep themselves distracted because there are interesting things to do in this life. And if you're fortunate, you can kind of keep your life busy the whole time. You know, Sudoku, crossword puzzles, TV programs, food. Then there's always food. And then there's always different food. And then there's a food that's really going to do it. Do that, you know. But not food. Then alcohol. Alcohol will do it. It's a sure-fired way to have pleasure for a short while. And so it's distracting. It's a way of getting away. Some people identify with their suffering really deeply. It's kind of who they think they are. They know they're suffering, but it's somehow, maybe not so consciously, but unconsciously, that's their whole identity has been built around it, the way people relate to them. They feel that maybe some people have a strategy that if they suffer, then people will take care of them. People will engage with them or commiserate. People will share each other's suffering, and it's a way of bonding and getting close. Sometimes it's a little bit of a power play. If you suffer enough, then other people will take care of you and feel guilty if they don't. And so it builds and becomes kind of a part of the identity. And it's frightening to let go of an identity. It's frightening to let go of the way that you've set up the world to survive, to get along, to do it. So there's probably all kinds of other reasons why people are tolerant of their suffering. In the Dharma, we want to learn to be intolerant of it in a wise way. And the wise way to be intolerant of it is sooner or later to be impeccably honest about it. To really be honest, I'm suffering, this is suffering. And not just, you know, sometimes the word, when we use the word suffering as a translation for dukkha, some people, well, the way they understand English, will understand it to mean catastrophic suffering. It's a catastrophic word. It's like the big stuff. And why do these people, Buddhists, always talk about the catastrophic, you know, these big things? But we use it, some people translate the word dukkha as stress. And so even the slightest, even small things that are stressful that we tolerate, we shouldn't tolerate. How do you drive your car? Do you drive in a stressful way? Or do you not know you drive stressfully because you're so focused on where you're getting to that you don't really pay attention to what's happening in your body and your mind? But there's lots of stress in driving. There's stress in just simply trying to beat the green, you know, beat the red light before it turns, you know, and then it's turned yellow. And then there's a stress of, do I go or do I brush? Do I not? Is someone watching? What do I do? And then you rush. That's a kind of dukkha. It's stress right there. What would happen if you were intolerant of that stress? Would you drive better? More safer? Would you drive with more care for the people around you as you drive? So all this, there's the subtlest things, and when you people develop their meditation, and the times of meditation gets really quiet and still, that's when the subtlest little forms of stress, of dukkha, become the guiding pathway of finding our way forward to the end of suffering. And it's mostly a lot of experience of peace and well-being, but there's a little bit of tension, a little bit of stress, a little sense of pressure that if you pay attention, yep, it's kind of unpleasant. It's not quite right. And so, in some sense, the deeper the meditation is, the more peaceful it is, the more useful it is to be attuned to the dukkha that's there, because that's the door that opens. In fact, there's something called the doors of liberation. And for some people, liberation, they go through the door of anicca, inconstancy, impermanence. Some people go through the door of suffering. And some people go through the door of having to do with not self. I'll say a little bit more about that. So this subtle is really paying attention carefully. What is here? So what is this word dukkha? In Pali, the word dukkha is the ordinary literal word for pain. And so when we say that, my computer was a pain in the ass, what we're saying is that we're suffering over the computer, but we use the word pain. Going down to the DMV was a pain. It was not painful. I just sat, you stood there and sat there, and the seats weren't comfortable, but you sat there and waited there, and but it was just kind of unpleasant, intensely unpleasant and boring and frustrating somehow. And so it's an emotional pain we're talking about. So dukkha is a kind of an emotional pain or psychological pain. But the basic meaning is pain, or it's actually an adjective, and it means painful. So there are three kind of painful things that the Buddha says, or categories of pain. There is painful pain, which is raw, basic physical pain that we can have. And then, from being injured or sick or for whatever reason, it's just raw physical pain. And then there's the pain of change. And now we're getting a little bit more into the realm of our psychology, our inner life, our mind, but not entirely. The dukkha of change kind of spans the range. So, for example, there's the change of getting older. And I think there's very few individuals currently alive who manage to get into old age and not have their body ache or hurt or, somehow or other not be the same as it was before. And so that just, so it's a change that comes, and the physical pain is just comes with the territory. It's not necessarily psychological, but it's that comes with change. And even more so in the time of the Buddha, because they had no pain medication then. And the Buddha, when he was an old man, the year he was dying, he talked about his physical pain, and the only time he ever got any relief was by going into deep meditation. It seems like the Buddha had a bad back. Maybe he's 7 years of asceticism. He might have easily have, done his back harm. And there were times when he is teaching that he would ask one of his disciples to finish the teaching because he was going to lay down because of his back. But when he got old, he described that his body was held together like an old cart, held together with rope, you know, all kinds of, you know, duct tape everywhere, if they had duct tape back then. And so, you know, relative to those times, you know, getting old these days is easier. I imagine that I probably wouldn't even be alive back then if, but because of medical treatment, kept me going. And I can see, I have glasses. I have, like, you know, a whole array of things between, I take my glasses off, between my you and my eyes. I have my glasses I can take off, and I have a cataract lens on one side and a contact lens on the other side, and all these things to try to manage. And then I have to figure out, do I wear my glasses? Do I not wear my glasses? And I have it easy. So there's change that involves loss. That's also inherent in life. People die. If you're lucky enough to grow to old age, your parents will die before you. And friends die, families die, all kinds of death that happens. There's loss. I've known people who've lost homes in the recent fires, last years. And it kind of happened suddenly. They weren't expecting it. Loss. I'm very conscious of living a mile from the San Andreas Fault. There could be, even while I'm sitting here talking, there could be a cataclysmic change in my life. My life might never be the same if that fault line moves. And so there's this change, but then it disrupts us. We lose something. And there's grief, there's sadness that might come. But sometimes when things change and stop and we lose them, it also is a relief. I remember I've sat many times on retreat and in pain, knee pain especially. And then they rang the bell. Oh, that was a change that was welcomed. Sometimes I've gotten this, one of the surprises was get so happy. Oh, like I was sitting there. Had they forgotten about the bell? Please ring the bell, my mind would scream, you know, bell, bell, ring. And I was just kind of bearing it, hardly bearing it, I guess. And then I was so glad when they rang the bell. Oh, it finally came to an end. And then I hadn't moved my posture at all. And if, wait a minute, where's the pain? It was gone. And so that was a little bit humbling. And I wondered, the posture hasn't changed. Where did the pain come from? What was that about? Was it really physical pain or was it my reactivity? What was that? And then someone sitting next to me who, you know, might have, I was happy the bell rings. I could easily imagine someone next to me said, oh no, they rang it too soon. Oh no, my meditation was so good. I finally got concentrated. I felt like I was going to get more on the edge of some new dimension of concentration. And why did they ring the bell? Didn't someone know that, you know, how good it was? And so, you know, so sometimes the same change can be disappointing and or elating. Part of the change and is that also it allows for new beginnings. When things come to an end, there's a new beginning. And sometimes that new beginning is we look forward to it. Sometimes it allows for something to occur that we never could have imagined without that new beginning. And sometimes something ends, and what we grieve is futures we imagined. But imagine futures we were living, anticipating. And it's not just that we lost a person or lost something that ended, but it's the future that implied that we expected to live. So the dukkha of change. Now that's related to the third kind of dukkha, which is the dukkha, the pain of the mental functionings we have, the pain of our mental constructs, our mental formations, sankhara dukkha. And this is kind of the good news, that our psychology is not hardwired in from a Buddhist point of view. I'm sure you could argue with me if you're a neurologist or something, but from a Buddhist point of view, our suffering is not hardwired in. And it's part of the software. It's part of the functioning. It's always an activity. There's a very strong tendency in early Buddhism to avoid, and it's more clear in Pali than it is the English translation, to avoid talking about the mind and mind states, as things, as nouns, but rather they're verbs, they're activities. They're not necessarily activities that we are always actions that we do, but they're activities. And activities, because something is active, turned on, doesn't mean it has to always be turned on. Just because conditions come together for a certain activity to exist in the mind doesn't mean that it has to always be there. If you're juggling balls for a long time, you could stop juggling the balls. And your mind is constantly juggling all these different psychological states, reactions, beliefs, opinions, desires, aversions. They're called constructions that we make. And the good news about that is that as we get to know, as we bring our attention to our inner life and really get quiet and still, we start seeing how these mental constructs can be quieted, can be stilled. Something is maybe inconceivable in a mind that never meditates, where it just everything seems to be on automatic pilot and kind of like it's hardwired, like there. But as things get quieter, the quieting of meditation begins to quiet the activity level. Things are not as active anymore. It's one of the reasons we do is to reduce the amount of external stimuli that keeps the mind activated. And we start seeing more clearly what's going on here. And one of the things to discover, one of the mental activities to become aware of, is how we relate to our suffering. So not necessarily to notice the cause of suffering first, but rather how we relate to it. Do we tolerate it, for example? Do we justify it? Do we identify with it? Do we take pleasure in it? Do we hate it? Do we have strong aversion to it? Do we identify with it in a negative way? Like somehow I must be a wrong person that I'm suffering. I must have done something wrong. It's a personal fault of my own or something. It's embarrassing. I feel shame over having it. Pity over having, the suffering. One relationship I've had with my suffering is the attack relationship. that I was going to just zero in and attack it and just kind of blow it. I was going to get rid of it. And I can tell you it didn't work. And I tried to use concentration as a way to avoid suffering. And that worked for a while. But it wasn't a lasting solution. So to look at one's relationship to it, because the relationship to suffering is not the suffering. Though it can be confused with the suffering, the relationship is optional. The relationship maybe can be questioned, can maybe be shifted to a different relationship. Whether suffering can be shifted or brought to an end, people will have maybe some doubts. But we can begin by this one step removed from the suffering, how we relate to it. And is it possible to find a way to relate to suffering that's unagitated, that's equanimous, that it has a kind of healthy willingness to be present for suffering? In fact, it's possible to have joy, it's kind of happiness and suffering at the same time. Isn't that remarkable? There can be an inspiration and joy. Oh, okay. Finally, this is what the practice is about, really to meet the suffering. Now's the chance to really be with it. I've prepared myself. I've cultivated stability. I've cultivated some modicum of well-being in my life. I lived a good life for a while, and I've cultivated a confidence and a strength. I know what mindfulness practice is. I practice it. I develop that muscle. So now I'm ready. This is good. This is what I've been training for. And to be inspired. Oh, okay. This is the time. That's a different relationship than being aversive. And this putting a question mark next to the way you relate to suffering is really healthy, as opposed to believing it has to be that way. That whatever way you relate to suffering, the attitude you have towards it, rather than assuming that it has to be that way, of course it's that way, or that's who I am, that's the kind of person I am. I'm that kind of person who gets afraid whenever they're suffering. What do you expect me to do? But you put a question mark next to it. Maybe not so. Maybe it doesn't have to be this way. Maybe I can be present in a different way. Maybe there can be a paradigm shift in how I be with suffering. And maybe that story of Suzuki Roshi being so happy talking about suffering can inspire you. Oh, well, maybe. Then you might be ready. Once you kind of found a kind of healthier, more appropriate, helpful way to relate to suffering, where you're willing to sit with it and not run away, willing to sit with it and not be agitated, willing to maybe hold it in the cupped hands of mindfulness. Just hold your suffering. And oh, there you go. There you go. It's possible that your suffering, your despair, your sadness, your grief, your anger, your fear, it's possible that what it most needs from you is a accepting mindfulness. Not the acceptance that condones it, but the kind of acceptance of a small child who is angry, and an adult just sits with them and doesn't condemn them, doesn't try to change them, just sits with them and lets them be upset for a while, and maybe has them sit on their lap, and the child relaxes and quiets down. So this ability to hold and be present in a non-reactive, non-judgmental way with suffering. And then at some point we might see that suffering is arising from a different relationship, a different relatedness. It might be that there's been change, or we're afraid of change. And we see that we relate to life with a craving, with strong, compulsive desire, with needing things to be a certain way, with resistance, pushing things away, with carrying with us an identity that I have to be this way, who I am inherently is a well-dressed person. And the fact that all my clothes are dirty and didn't get cleaned is a disaster for this day when I go out with my dirty old wrinkled clothes, because my identity is completely tied up in my clothes. So that's maybe a silly example, but you can fill it in better. It was certainly a wonderful challenge to be a parent walking through the supermarket aisles with a 2 or 3 year old who was screaming as if I had just tortured them to the, you know, I was like the worst parent that anyone had ever seen. And the only thing I did was, no, you can't have whatever it was that the kid wanted in that aisle. Every aisle, the kid wanted something. So then my identity, you know, people must think I'm a terrible parent. And I need to be a good-looking parent for everybody else, right? After all, I'm a Dharma teacher. Heaven forbid that people who practice with me hear that I went through the aisles with a screaming child. So we see that we hold on to identities, we hold on to desires, we hold on to cravings, we hold on to resentments, we hold on to all kinds of things. And the holding on is an activity of the mind. It takes energy, it takes work. It's tiring. One of the ways to have wisdom around suffering is to get tired of it. Enough already. But not the tiredness that causes you to give up, but the tiredness that maybe inspires courage, a courage to stop and look at it and be with it, to get to the bottom of it, to get through it. But not ambitiously. Don't be in a hurry. Perhaps you can be with your suffering, calling upon whatever ability you have to be steady, stable, still. Maybe you can call on whatever capacity that's available for well-being, and happiness. Don't be mesmerized by the suffering. Don't be pulled into its charisma so that you feel like you have to kind of just suffer more. Can you call upon a sense of equanimity and goodness, generosity, kindness? Can this whole movement towards feelings being with suffering be an expression of care? Really caring for yourself, caring for the world, doing it not only for yourself, but doing it for others, to really connect and be with. So be tired of the suffering, tired of suffering again and again. Let's try a different way. Let's try the practice way. Let's call on the best qualities that we might have to whatever degree we have. Let's sit up straight. And to be willing then to look and see and not to chase after happiness. Not to require yourself to be happy. Not to assume that there's something out there that can happen differently that will make you happy. The right relationship, the right job, the right vacation, the right bank account, the right entertainment, the right drug. Even in a certain way, the right meditation experience. The pursuit of true happiness doesn't quite work. But to go through suffering, to really stop and see and discover what the mind is doing, be quiet enough, kind enough, caring enough, so that the mind begins to reveal how it's actually, what's actually going on in there. And I like to repeat that, be quiet enough, still enough, kind enough, caring enough, so the mind will reveal to you what's really going on deep down inside. And where is the holding? Where is the clinging? Where is the grasping? And allow possibility for that to release, to let go. And then, when it begins to let go, there is a kind of a happiness there. A kind of a happiness. I say kind of because if you have a hand in a fist for a long time and it hurts and you get used to it, you think that's all I've had. And then somebody tells you, you know, it's okay, you can open your hand. And wow, I had no idea. I had no idea you can live this way with an open hand and the fingers can be relaxed. Wow, this feels so good. And so you want to grab it. And as soon as you grasp at the open hand, guess what happens? You lose it. So the open hand is not quite a thing that's graspable. There's no true open hand in this, in a kind of way. So the same thing with this happiness thing. It doesn't exist in a way that allows you to grasp it. It exists, but it doesn't exist. It's there, but it's not quite there. Because as soon as you try to touch it or grab it, it's not available. Now, maybe this is discouraging to hear, because you want to be able to have something to show for yourself. And sit quietly. Caringly, compassionately, with whatever is present. It doesn't have to be the suffering. The classic instructions in mindfulness is to be present for what is. And if it's happiness, do that. If it's suffering, do that. If it's neither, do that. Just be. Be still, be quiet, listen from a place of deep listening, deep receptivity, as if the mind, the heart, when it feels safe enough, you've helped it feel safe enough, it reveals something to you. And to do this practice is to do a practice that offers that kind of safety to your heart. If you're condemning or engineering and trying too hard, the heart won't feel safe. And so to be quiet and let really listen, and what will be revealed when the heart feels safe under it all? And at some point, for some people, suffering, just being this honest, patient, peacefully, quietly with the core fundamental place of holding or tension or grasping in their lives. There's this door that appears, kind of. Door, it doesn't appear, the door, when it appears, it's already open. Open door. That's called the wishless. That has no wishes, no desires. And for some people, it's only when they come to the place where there's no desires whatsoever that this door opens up and you step through to liberation, the greatest happiness. And so there's three doors, as I said, one associated with impermanence, one associated with suffering, and one associated with not self. And it seems like no one ever chooses which door opens for them. But one of the doors is the door of the wishless, having no desires. And I offer that to you, not because it's going to be your door, but rather as a reference point that there's in the right time and place, there is a season, there is a time to experience life, experience yourself, having no desires whatsoever. A vacation from desires. Wouldn't that be nice? So, perhaps you can be a little bit more intolerant to your suffering, but the kind of intolerance that provides you with the motivation to look at it more deeply. To not turn away from it, but really see it. And one of the first things you might do is spend some time with recognizing your relationship to this, to suffering. And once you feel like the relationship is a healthy relationship, one that you would like, a relationship that you'd like a friend to have towards you, then maybe then you can look deeper and listen deeply and see what wants to be revealed at the heart of the suffering, if you help your suffering feel safe. It's a radical idea. Help your suffering feel safe so something can be revealed. And then the Buddha talks about, as I said earlier, the two positive ways he talks about liberation. Sometimes he talks about it as being peace, and sometimes he talks about it as being happiness. A peaceful happiness, a happy peace. Perhaps if you sit this evening or tomorrow morning, perhaps you can get a small hint from deep within of your capacity for peaceful happiness, a happy peace. Don't think it's so far away. So thank you, and I wish you well in this exploration we're all doing.